First of all, I want to say that I'm grateful for all of you. We've really had a core group through these last 7 weeks, and you've stuck in there. And I'm super grateful to see so many of you kind of make it through the end. I want to just refer you guys back to the website if you missed any. That I believe is up to date as well, and it has the outlines on there as well. And I also want to mention as something I've mentioned several times throughout the course, which is that next year, in the new year, we're planning on having a class for non-believers. And so we're encouraging folks you've been talking to, people you'd like to kind of interact with over the big questions of life, for you to encourage to hop on and attend some. We're thinking, we have some various ideas on how to do this, but it's still in the works. And I just want to invite all of you who've kind of been the core group throughout to let me know kind of if you have ideas or feedback or suggestions for the best way to do this. We were thinking something that might be on the lines of, you know, 4 weeks instead of 7 weeks. And of course, the content would be a little different, because here I've been obviously talking to, a Zoom room full of believers, and I would be very aware of having non-believers in the room as we talk about kind of the big questions of life. But if you have feedback, if you have ideas, I'd love to hear that. We're going to be putting more hands and feet on this in the next several weeks and during the holiday season. So feel free to send those emails to me. As far as tonight goes, again, I want to encourage you to use the chat feature to send in questions. Don't wait until the end on that. You can use the chat feature. I'm the only one who sees those. I'll take that back. Sherry and Susan are who are kind of in the background of this that you don't typically see, I think see those as well. But the three of us are the only ones who see those. And we will, I'll try to get to as many of those as I can at the end of tonight. So week 7, inviting others into the Christian story. And tonight I really want to focus on practical advice for conversations. Now, as I initially thought of this week, I kind of thought I'm going to get into lots of different defeaters, but by defeaters, I mean just objections that people have. But what I've done instead is I'm leading off with some really practical guidance for conversations. And then I've reserved a lot of room tonight, hopefully, Lord willing, for you to send in questions and for us to have a conversation about dealing with objections or just things that have come up through the last 7 weeks. It's been on your mind, maybe you've been trying to have one of these conversations and something's come up, a problem's come up. And so I want to reserve that time tonight for just some dialogue and some questions that you have. So we're going to start off tonight. Here's the game plan introduction. I just want to remind you about loving your neighbor in these conversations. How do we communicate love? How do we love the person we're talking to? And that can sound great, but then how do you actually put that into practice? And I have 6 lessons that I'm drawing from Proverbs, really because what we're talking about is wisdom here. Because when you get in a conversation, there's not, you know, 20 things, there's not a set, here are the 8 steps you take, but you have to use wisdom, which means that it's not just set out in black and white always. And what I've found on this, in this area of wisdom and practical wisdom, the Proverbs is just, you know, it's just a treasure trove of ideas and teaching. So I want to explore that just for a few minutes tonight. And then a reminder about speaking the truth in love. And even though it's love, it's going to be hard things. There's going to be hard things we have to say. So we're still speaking the truth. But we're wanting to do it in love. And then we'll get into the kind of ask anything. So you can see, I try to keep it brief tonight as far as where we're going. So several years ago, I read this book. It's called Dialogical Apologetics. And this is one of the key things that David Clark in the book says that really stuck with me. He said, sometimes a person who speaks to an apologist feels like an object, like yet another notch on the handle of a gunslinger six shooter. An apologist's dialogue partners do not always sense genuine concern for them. This negative feeling can build tremendous resistance. People pull hardest when they are pushed hardest. I think the point that he's making here is a really practical one, which is the gunslinger kind of approach to conversations is rarely effective in actually persuading the unconvinced. I rarely talk to someone who's become a Christian and say, how did you become a Christian? And it was that they were kind of bullied intellectually into a corner and then forced to concede, okay, I believe in God, I'll follow Christ. I think most of us, at least in theory, recognize this. But my concern is nevertheless too often in practice, because I think because of what I see modeled on TV and in other places where debates happen, conversations can look like kind of an old Western rather than what it should be. In other words, I think when we actually get into these conversations, things can get heated and it can be hard to avoid, or we make another mistake, we just back off and run away from talk of religion. And so just to remind you, that, I mean, the only, I'm not sure if I discussed this in the first week or not, but the only place in the New Testament where it actually uses this word apologetics, apologia, is 1 Peter 3:15. And it's done, there's, of course, 1 Peter, the book is framed where the church is being persecuted. And he says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that's within you. And so number one, apologetics is framed by a persecuted community here who is experiencing persecution, but who are living a life of hope. Things are hard, but they've embodied a certain hope because of, and I would argue to go back to where we ended last week, because they really believed in the resurrection, because they really believed this historical event and that has changed them. But he also adds in 1 Peter, that they're to do it, they're to give a reason with gentleness and respect. And now, if you know anything about Peter, which everyone on here does, Peter wasn't always known for this. Remember, he was the one who wanted to pick up the sword when they came for Jesus. Peter was the one who was very bold and out in front and at times aggressive, and yet he's learned something because of the cross. No doubt he learned something because of Jesus' words, you know, hey, I haven't come to be served, but to serve. And so the New Testament emphasis, there's an emphasis on, you know, like in, for instance, Paul in Colossians 4, 5, and 6, being wise in the way that you act towards outsiders. Let your conversations be seasoned with salt and always full of grace. And so there's this way that we interact with unbelievers, with outsiders, that's full of grace and humility. And now this can all sound good, as I mentioned before, but how does this actually play out? What are some principles or some lessons from the Proverbs? And I emphasized earlier in my opening statements about wisdom. And I put it like this, you know, these are two of my favorite Proverbs, and it's because they're paradoxical. I mean, listen to Proverbs 26, 4 and 5. We're instructed not to answer a fool according to his folly, because you yourself will be just like him. But then the next verse tells us that we should answer a fool according to his folly, because otherwise he will be wise in his own eyes. So this opens the question, what's going on? You can't say that there's just a contradiction here. I mean, a blatant contradiction that the author is, you know, just says one thing here and says something else somewhere else that contradicts himself accidentally. They're right there together. So I think the point that's being made is we have to be wise people to know how to answer in different situations. What changes here is there can be a different context, there can be a different situation which requires us to answer in a different way. And I believe the Proverbs themselves are the best place to go to learn this kind of wisdom. So here are six lessons from the Proverbs I want to go through to kind of guide us as we're thinking about our conversations, especially over the holiday, especially over family, with family, over Thanksgiving and Christmas, and with our neighbors. Number one, listen and take others seriously. Proverbs 18:13, to answer before listening, this is folly and shame. To not assume that you know what they're going to say, yes, I've heard all this before, but to step inside and listen very carefully. I think we shouldn't expect others to take us seriously if we're not willing to take them seriously, to listen seriously to them. We can actually set the tone and lead by example in a conversation by how carefully we're listening, by allowing the other person to speak. I think one of the things that at times I found helpful, depending on the context, is to say, hey, I want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying correctly. Is this what you're saying? Can I, you know, and then I sum it up in their own words, and my own words. And it communicates, hey, I'm listening to your ideas and I'm taking it very seriously. Number two, avoid falsely representing the other side. This is about, you know, speaking truthfully, not only truth about the gospel and about God, but speaking truthfully about the other side, about what this person is saying. A false witness will perish, but a careful listener will testify successfully. So as we're listening, we're also wanting to make sure we're representing the other side. The kind of logical fallacy, you guys, some of you have maybe studied logical fallacies, but the logical fallacy that I'm referring to here is called a straw man argument. And this happens all the time. You could go on news shows and just have plenty of examples with the talking heads, especially the entertainment driven, which is most of them now, as they're making different arguments. And this is where you present a weak argument, or you present someone else's argument, in a way that they would never articulate it. Or you accuse them of believing things that they don't actually believe. And the quickest way in a conversation is to kind of, you know, parrot certain talking points that somebody who's critiquing this person's view holds to, without actually and in actually misrepresenting them, and they don't feel like you're treating them fairly or hearing them. And so this is why the first one's so important, to listen and take them seriously. Don't assume because you've studied atheism that they, and you've studied a particular atheist, and I presented some general kind of atheistic arguments, don't assume just because I've presented it in this way, in a particular way, that this actually represents this particular person's view. And begin to articulate and share with them what they believe. Let them share with you what they believe before you go there, and work hard to represent them fairly. Resist assuming motives. We've got to be careful here, because I do believe, for instance, Proverbs 25, that the purpose of a person's heart are deep waters, but one who has insights draws them out. So one of the things I've been stressing here in the last 7 weeks is that people are believing and disbelieving for a variety of reasons, and that we're complex as human beings. And it's not simply that we're reasoning our way to truth, but coming to truth is both a combination of emotional reasons, existential reasons, yes, logical reasons, but they're all working together. And so one of the things when you after hearing that, you might be quick, and I want to guard you from doing this, be quick to say, hey, you're not believing because, and then assign certain motives to them. You know, you can't, you know, to quote the old movie with Tom Cruise, you know, you can't handle the truth. That's why you don't believe. You don't, you don't want to believe, and that's why you can't handle the truth. I mean, that's why you're not, that's why you can't handle the truth. You don't want there to be God. Therefore you're saying there is no God and that's it. You know, that might be the case. I don't think that's going to be effective in persuading them. And it's assuming certain motives when, you know, to be honest, I think most people have lots of motives, and it, and a lot of times they're not even fully aware of those motives. So, but with that, I think asking good questions, drawing them out in conversation, I think sometimes together, especially if you're trying to facilitate a kind of environment and create a type of conversation where there's openness, where you show them your scars, I think that can create a kind of space for them to actually say, hey, they can become more aware through the conversations of some of their motives here. And you can ask questions to draw this out. So again, it's trying to get underneath and trying to understand, trying to draw them out without assigning motives in a way that's going to kind of close them off to considering more deeply. Number four, when you can find points of agreement to affirm, when you can, right? There's gonna at times be challenge, but if there's a way to, again, facilitate a conversation that doesn't stir up anger, but says, hey, where can we find some common ground to begin the conversation? Okay, you know, you don't believe, I'm deeply committed as a Christian, let's talk. Let's talk about what it means to be human, where we find meaning, and some of these categories that I've been reflecting on and are in your notes. I'm trying to give you some categories, some space that you can kind of, some things you can set up that you can begin to talk about in a way that even if the person isn't religious at all, they're thinking about and living and basing their life on. So this isn't, again, I'm wanting to be clear here, this isn't a neutral space. I'm not saying that anyone can come in here and take on a big question like God without certain biases. We all have biases. And but what I am saying is something that the Bible teaches, that Romans 1, although we suppress the truth, we still have certain intuitions as human beings that have been deeply implanted in us by God. And so, you know, all people worship, for instance, we all worship something, we all find meaning and identity in something. And so, you know, we because of that, that gives us a kind of common ground to begin a conversation. And so I think one of the things here is, where can I look for some points of agreement to begin the conversation? Number five, resist focusing on the periphery. Where there is strife, there is pride. And I think what I'm trying to get at here is, I think sometimes we have these kind of clashes because, hey, this person rejects God and the gospel, and the key kind of core tenets of what we believe. And so there's this animosity, and there's this real disagreement that we have to face up to. But at other times, I think we go into this and we get distracted, and we focus on things that aren't central to our faith. And we need to remember what we're doing, and we need to kind of keep focused. And one way to do this is, this is what I call an apologetic triage. We need to learn how to do apologetic triage or evangelistic triage. And many of you probably know what a medical triage is. If you go to the emergency room and you have a injury, they go up there and you check in, and they're going to ask you what's going on. And if you say, hey, I've bent my finger back and I think it's dislocated, you're going to probably rank pretty low on getting in that evening if it's crowded. If you go in and saying, I'm having chest pains, you're likely to get in much quicker, right? Because they're triaging, okay, what's what's vital here? What's, is this person in a life or death situation, or they can they be put towards the end of the line so we can address more serious injuries right away? And that's right and good. And I'm glad they do that, even though it stinks if it's your finger and you're having to wait. Now, a triage for our witness for evangelism says, okay, I'm in this conversation, and this person is bringing up lots of different things. Some things I really disagree with. They're talking politics, and I really disagree with their political views. I think some of the things they're saying are just silly and dumb. And the tendency at that point can be, okay, I need to respond every single point that I disagree with them on. And if you don't pick and choose what you will address, I think our conversations end up being kind of, 15-round sparring matches and have lots of fireworks, and you're never going to build a kind of atmosphere that is going to open them up and is going to talk about the core issues of Christian belief. And I think one of the issues going on there is there's kind of this pride that says, no, I'm gonna fix them. I'm going to show them that they're silly or wrong, or I need to correct them on all these different things. But what a triage does, gospel triage or evangelistic triage, says, okay, what's the most important thing here? Paul calls the gospel the power of God that brings salvation. And he says it's of first importance. He says this is of first importance in 1 Corinthians 15 when he's giving this outline of the gospel. And so I think for us to say, okay, I'm in this conversation with a person. He's saying, he or she is saying things that I find objectionable, problematic and disturbing on a number of levels. How can I best help this person? How can I be a faithful presence in this conversation? And I think, first of all, our allegiance is to say, hey, if I can talk about salvation that's found in by faith alone in Christ, if I can talk about how Jesus rose from the grave, if I can talk about the bigger questions of meaning and morality that link up and connect to Jesus and the gospel, that's where I want to go. And even on these kind of religious fronts, they might bring up something like the age of the earth. Well, I can't believe in Christianity. What's your view on the age of the earth? Or, I was reading the gospels and I found that, you have these different timings of the temple clearings. Was there more than one temple clearing? How do you resolve that? And I don't think those kind of issues are insignificant, the age of the earth or the number of times Jesus cleared the temple courts, and we could list a lot of other things there. But what I'm saying is they're not essential for salvation. This person, salvation, the gospel doesn't hang on them. And so I think having this kind of grid of saying, even being aware of, okay, hey, what do I really need to talk about? What do I really need to challenge this person on? Where do I really want to take this conversation? And that takes some discipline. But I think if not, conversations will often, sometimes intentionally by the other person, they don't want to talk about those hard things. There's an initial resistance to talk about that. And so they'd rather get you talking about these peripheral things. But sometimes it's just, hey, this thought came in their mind. And if you take that bait, you will be somewhere else, far in the distance of where you want to be in the conversation. And I know this from experience because I've done it too many times. And so let me drill in a little bit more on this. This is important. And it also has to do not just with, it has to do some objections that people have. And one of the questions is that sometimes will come up is about Genesis 1 and 2. And it's about, okay, what's your belief about the age of the earth? What is your belief about Genesis 1 and 2? Because, you can get, objections that hey, well, it just doesn't fit with modern science. It's what we know about the world. And so I would suggest to you a couple of things. One is to think about what are the essential elements of what Genesis 1 and 2 were saying. In other words, there's these, you know, some people read that in a way that's more literal. Others read it in a way that's more symbolic and metaphorical. And many people are in between reading it in a combination of different ways. And what I'm wanting to say, what are things that have to be true there for the rest of the Bible to make sense? And I'm getting this, as you see on the slide, from Francis Schaeffer and D.A. Carson. And their point is, okay, so I'll give you a few examples. So God created. That God is ultimate and he created everything. That seems to be fundamental to the storyline. You have this God who created good. You have humans who have turned away from God and sinned and turned from worshiping him. That's Genesis 3. And this had massive impact on the world and on the rest of human race. I could go on with some core things, but what I'm saying isn't so core is, for instance, the age of the earth. I'm saying that there's space, and this gets to number two, there's space and different interpretive options that exist within the Orthodox, which means the kind of standard Christian tradition and doctrine. And so when you are in a conversation with an unbeliever, I think it helps to recognize on this issue that you have believers, Christians who believe the gospel, who have a spectrum of views on this. And so not forcing this unbeliever to come in and take maybe your position within that spectrum, wherever that might be, but leaving some space and saying, here are some options. That there are some people who believe in, you know, yeah, if you're asking, there's some people who believe that the earth is young, and there's some people who believe it's old, you know, really old. There's some people believe that God created through certain evolutionary processes. And there's a spectrum of Christians on the end, for instance, C.S. Lewis or Alvin Plantinga, who I've mentioned in this course before. So there's a spectrum of Christians who believe the gospel, who affirm different things on this point. Now, in some sense, I'm kicking the can on it, but I'm intentionally doing so because what someone believes on that issue isn't going to save them, okay? And so I want to avoid forcing their hand. Now, some might argue, well, you can't be consistent and hold to this view as a Christian. Well, maybe, maybe not. That's really an intramural debate within Christianity. So I'm wanting, again, this is where I think the triage helps us. And being aware of kind of what other Christians believe on this kind of really controversial issue amongst Christians can be helpful as you're engaging other people to give them some options. And I do this with other things too. I have some other issues too where I want to, as C.S. Lewis said, C.S. Lewis was arguing mere Christianity. He wanted not to get people in a particular Christian tradition within a particular room, but he wanted to get them in the big house. He wanted them to get them in the doorway. And so my approach is to help people get into the doorway, not necessarily within my particular tradition. Okay, that was a longer one. And you guys might have some questions at the end of that. And I welcome that. Number six, avoid being unnecessarily antagonistic. And this is really hitting a point that I've hit several times here, but it is to one's honor to avoid strife, but every fool is quick to quarrel. And I say this because I think sometimes amongst conservative evangelicals, which I count myself one of those, it's almost an honor to have this quarrel with non-believers, to have strife. And I just don't think that's right. Now, granted, at times strife is going to come. There's going to be deep disagreements, but I don't think. But that's ultimately not what we're going for. But even as I say that, I want to kind of end this kind of my opening talk, and then use the final 30 minutes for discussion with this point. Even though I'm emphasizing this kind of humility, this love for the person we're talking to, I don't want to be confused of offering some kind of compromise. I mean, we see this in Jesus, that he modeled both grace and truth in his life and in his teaching. And so I'm talking about humility, I'm talking about love, but I'm also talking about holding to truth boldly and firmly. And so at the points where the truth of the gospel collides with the sensibilities of our culture, we need to, yes, have humility before the other person, but ultimately our humility, and this is stressed throughout the book of Proverbs, is before God, that we fear God. And so we stand under his word. We want to help people understand his word, begin to imagine the world differently, imagine, for instance, how a God could judge and be right to judge. So I want to help them kind of step into that doctrine and hard doctrines like judgment and justice and look at it from different angles. But it's not saying we need to do away with God's wrath or God's judgment, or we need to hide from that. So yes, it's stepping in that, giving them some categories to understand and think about that maybe in a way they haven't thought about it, but it's not hiding from it, and it's not in any way running from it. So yes, we've got to do this with humility and love, but that in no way means we compromise the truth of the gospel. All right, I'm going to skip this for now. If we run out of questions, I have a video, but I'm going to stop my share and I'm going to open up, and I see there's some chat here. So let me jump into some questions, and then I'm going to take a few, and then you can, if I don't get to yours after I take one or two, I'm just going to kind of open it up for conversation. And once I do that, you'll probably have to unmute to speak, and then you can mute yourself again. Yeah, I would say this is a question. My friend has been in church her whole life. It's very important to her. And she loves her church. However, she believes that there are many ways to reach God, and to say that Jesus is the only way is very exclusive. What question do I ask her? Yeah, that's a good question. And I think I would say, I would want to talk to her more about, you know, exclusivity, and to try to ask her more of, you know, kind of the issue with, for one thing, I would want to say, hey, if this is someone who is affirming the Bible, which it sounds like they might be, then I would want to talk to them about, well, these are Jesus's words. So this is, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So as somebody who goes to church and I guess generally affirms the scripture, how do you understand this? And for somebody who's giving credence to the Bible, I think there's a place to start. In other words, how do you deal with this? And then I would want to share at that point, hey, you know, because I believe Jesus is Lord, then if Jesus made this claim, for one, then I don't feel at liberty to kind of adjust that because of modern sensibilities. I think I would want to talk about modern sensibilities and ask her to consider how much she's also impacted by kind of modern sensibilities on this. That, you know, that if Jesus really is Lord, then, or if there is a God, then he would have to do things the way I imagine it. And that would be in this way that lets everybody in who's apparent. Could be because they're a good person. In other words, one way to take the conversation is, well, then how do people get in? Okay, if it's not Jesus, what's the way? And so see what she says or he says at that point, And if the way is, well, you have to be good enough. Well, that, if you actually think about that, that's rather kind of exclusive, because then you're saying you have to be good enough. You have to act a certain way. And we know that people actually come from different kind of moral backgrounds and different have different upbringings. So kind of a high morality is very difficult for probably these standards are almost impossible for some people given their background. So it raises some of the kind of questions about really the gospel. Is that's what I'm trying to, that's kind of one way to get there, about Jesus's lordship, but also about the gospel itself. How are we saved? Because my fear is that they, through this kind of desire for tolerance or inclusivity, they actually open up the door for other ways. And the other ways is probably going to be, in my experience, you've got to be good enough. And I think that raises some things you can explore more through other questions. What is a modern sensibility? So you guys are keeping me honest here on the chat. So a modern sensibility is a way that you inherit seeing the world that isn't going to be found in, it's not a universal, in other words. In other words, you have this kind of intuition or this sense about how things have to be or what God must be like. And you haven't just, you haven't come to that through reason. You've come to that because you've inherited certain ways of seeing the world through the stories that are told, to go back to our early weeks, and in our culture of movies, media. And so that shaped the way you actually kind of imagine God, to what God must be like. But actually, if you study history, that's not how, you know, for instance, most traditional societies view God. They, you know, some traditional societies, their kind of sensibility would be, how could a God forgive somebody who's immoral? And so their sense isn't, yeah, well, God's got to pretty much let everybody in, but their sensibility would be, no, you have to reach this really high standard. And so what I'm trying to get them to do at that point is to think through some of their kind of beliefs and where they got them from, and why they believe so strongly in those. And a lot of times it's just because they've assumed those. I think that there is an approach in a conversation where you're saying, hey, those are big questions. And I don't think Keller was saying we don't deal with those. We do deal with those, but I think there's some kind of pastoral wisdom, or just wisdom we can use to say, hey, let's circle back around. Those are big questions and they're important. You kind of got to judge where people are at. But how do you leave or exit conversations? How do you follow up? How do you take next steps? Really, really good practical questions. I think, you know, how do you leave a conversation? I mean, this is how do you leave? And that's again a wisdom question. There's no standard way to leave one of these conversations. I think you could say, you know, one of the things I do is, I've said, hey, this is a good conversation. I'd love to talk to you more about it. I think there can be opportunities to say, would you mind if I pray for you? I sense that the Lord's doing something, and our conversation today wasn't a coincidence, that the Lord's at work, and I love to pray for you if that's okay. And then, you know, one of the ways now in these days, it's really easy to follow up through text. Just, you know, being thoughtful and saying, I just want to follow up. And the great thing about a text is, you know, you don't have to make it too long, but you can make sure you craft exactly what you want to say, and you have time to think and reflect on that. So sending a message is always a great way to follow up, and it can lead to that second conversation, something for you to pick up on. The question is, here's a question coming in. People resist on the basis of their intelligence, too smart to be taken in. How do we address that? Well, again, it can depend they're probably saying more than that. But I, one way to go about this is, look, there's really smart people who believe in God. there's really, really smart people who don't believe in God. And so if you're saying, hey, I'm just too smart and all smart people don't believe in God, well, you know, I can, and we can talk about this, but there's, I can give you lists of names of, for instance, I mentioned, I'll just give you one, Francis Collins, who is director of, oh, I always mix up, somebody will help me here in the chat box, but director of National Health Service, head of the Human Genome Project, really one of the great National Institutes of Health, thank you. And so really one of the great scientists of the United States, and he's a firm Orthodox Christian believer. And the list can go on. Now, that's not saying that if you're smart enough, you're going to believe. But what it is saying is that there's smart people who believe and there's smart people who don't believe. And so if you're saying, well, it's just a matter of intelligence that you don't believe, if you're smart enough, you wouldn't believe, like there's just a lot of like actual empirical evidence that says that's not how this shakes out. And it's, so it's actually a rather naive thing to say. And depending on how well I know the person, depending on how, you know, how that conversation's going would depend on how blunt I'm going to be about that. And so that's a place to start. Just say, hey, well, that doesn't actually fit the data. I'm happy to talk data, and we can talk about people who believe and don't believe, but I'm not questioning your intelligence because you're an atheist, but I think you are wrong. And on this point, you're naive to suggest that, you know, people who believe are unintelligent or less intelligent than you. Yeah, so, and John's in a helpful way pushing back here. There are PhDs at MIT who are believers. It's certainly true, sadly, that the percentage of skeptics at elite universities is high. Yeah, I mean, so there's actually, there's some mixed data here. Some of it is, you know, what disciplines you teach in, but also there's studies coming out that, you know, the kind of belief in God, there's still pretty high kind of belief in God, but it is true that kind of the percentage compared to like, if you're looking at certain elite schools, versus, you know, just kind of the general population, that the general population is going to have a higher belief in God, as far as from what I've seen. I think the issue here is there's several strands going there that you can't make an interpretive leap too far there. For one, it's kind of self-selecting, right? I mean, okay, in order to teach at certain schools, then there's certain reasons to kind of keep your head down if you are a Christian or if you believe in God. And so there's certain actual, you know, the way that people get selected for faculty positions is the faculty selects them. And so there's several things going on. One is you know, to rise up kind of and get tenure, you keep your head down on certain controversial issues like God. And also the fact that there's a kind of self-selecting group. But even as I say that, I think that there's also data that shows there's still a good number of people at elite universities who believe in God. And below that, not as high as that believe in God, but who are Christians and committed to some kind of form of Christianity. Okay, let me take off the Zoom, and I mean, I'm going to go off chat and just see if you guys want to through your kind of voice, if there's any questions or things that have come up, maybe defeaters, objections that I haven't covered through the several weeks.
Yeah, hey, Josh. Good evening. It's Tim Roth.
Hey, Tim.
Hi, Josh. Can I add a seventh proverb to your six proverbs?
Sure.
Well, you can. I'm not sure of the notation. I didn't look it up. I just know it. It says, each heart knows its own bitterness and no one else can share its joy. I just think that's hugely important to know where what people have gone through. And that takes questions, takes some probing. And it's scary when people begin to open up. I mean, you realize, oh my gosh, they lost a daughter or they're, you know, they lost their mother at an early age or they had a bad experience in church. Take your pick. And you don't know that unless you ask them, but each heart knows its own bitterness and no one else can share its joy. And I think that's you're probing into their past and you're showing a sincere interest in them by doing that. But that requires questions and it requires listening.
Mm-hmm.
That's my seventh proverb. So
yeah, that's good. And it goes back to really some of the opening couple of talks that we had about, and this actually one of the questions that have just come in is, what are some questions to find out where a person is coming from before we engage in a Christian conversation? And the big general question is, hey, tell me your story. And as you're talking about your story, it's, what's the most important things to you in life? What are some of the turning points? Have you ever thought back of, here's some real turning points in your life? And has God ever factored into that equation? You can get to that point. I mean, you can, again, this takes wisdom, but you can start off by just saying, tell me these turning points and tell me, the big story of your life. I want to hear it. And I think oftentimes you will get a sense, if you're listening carefully, what the person really values, what they're trying to find life in. And oftentimes what that will do is that when you're opening up the conversation and you're asking good, thoughtful questions, not gotcha questions, but wanting to find out more about their background, the person will turn around and ask you the same question. That's an opportunity to give your story and to be prepared, as First Peter says, to give the reason for the hope that's within you. And as we're doing that, to show them your wounds, to show them your scars, to have a kind of vulnerability through that. Not that I believed in Jesus and then everything took care of itself, but this story about how Jesus is shaping you even still and has changed your life and is giving you a hope. So those are, I think I can't emphasize that enough, those good opening questions to set the pace for a conversation. So good. Tim added a seventh proverb and then we tackled another question. What else? I might have skipped over some. I'm trying to go back and scroll through, but if somebody has one while I'm doing that, please jump in.
Josh, my chat observation was too long to be accepted.
I'm sorry about that.
The question came up about, the exclusivity of Christ's claim. I am the only way. I think that one way of looking at it is, if you accept the position of the Bible that man has fallen, and a man is so fallen that he can't live a life pleasing to God, then the Christian answer that Christ's sacrifice on the cross was necessary, it kind of follows as the logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And that would rule out everything else. So, I can get there if I just let myself go and meditate enough, or whatever, one of the other world religions may say. Most of them are, some kind of works orientation, which.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is that I think that the Christian statement of the problem leads to what would end up being the only logical conclusion, that God has to intervene for us.
Yeah. No, that's that That's really good. And I'm glad that you've interjected on that. That's helpful. Because I needed a second part to how I answered, I answered first by going, this is what the Bible teaches to someone who's saying, at least in generally, they respect the Bible and they go to church. So I'm kind of pushing on them on kind of the question of lordship. And then what I was thinking was, okay, how do I explore their option here to show them that it has problems? In other words, they're saying, well, kind of like, I don't really, again, I wouldn't assume I would ask these, but I would try to get there in a conversation, because they're saying, well, I don't think this is right. I don't think this is fair. And so a loving God that I see in other places the Bible talks about would have to act like this. And I'm saying, okay, let's explore that some more. So then how are people saved then? And then I'm showing how, well, if you go works-based, then here's the problem. If you say everybody gets in, well, then there's a problem of justice. And so then I'm kind of, again, in a course of a conversation, I would be going back and forth and saying, well, wouldn't that just be a works-based salvation? And then I would be bringing problems up with the works-based salvation. And I would say, and eventually, after I've kind of said, I think all of these are problematic that you're giving, then, and I might not have to go through all that, I would go into what you're suggesting, which is what I left out. And I think it's exactly right, which is to say, hey, actually, I think you're misunderstanding the Christian claim here. You know, and that's tougher if someone's saying you're a Christian, but the Christian claim here is that we as humans have turned away. And so it's not that we actually can't ever be good enough, and we've turned away from God, and it takes this radical act of God's grace to step into our world and to save us through taking our place on the cross and taking the judgment we deserve. So, thanks for that. I needed to expand that. So there's a, notice what I'm doing. I'm saying, okay, where is this person at? They're affirming the church and the Bible, so I can start there. Okay, this person's still trying to take this other option. Let's explore that with them. Let me ask some more questions there. Okay, now let me work back around, now that I've stepped inside of what they're saying, show them what I think are the problems in a respectful way, and say, hey, let's return back to the actual claim that Christians are making here. The claim that I think the Bible's making. And then again, there's the gospel. And it takes them back to this kind of core truth of Christianity. Okay. Hi. Yeah, jump in here.
Yeah, I think that this approach is it gives a lot of freedom. I think that there's maybe many of us grew up in where you have to get the gospel out. You have to get them to a conversion. You have to, you know, it becomes a works oriented thing, really. But there's a real freedom to listen to God, try to figure out how God's already working in that person, and not feel like you have to like cinch something right away, but allow God to work both in that person and in the conversations that you have and leading you. And I think that that's a really freeing thing.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I think that, I love what you said. I mean, that God, and I want to, that the Spirit has to work in God. God saves, right? And so he uses, this is the glorious part. He uses people like me and you. And that means that we're not going to have all the answers. And yet that's okay. You know, that's okay. We're going to stumble and we're going to learn trial and error. And we're going to say, oh, I wish I would have said this. You know what? It gives me greater confidence that I know this God's using me, and it takes the kind of weight off my shoulder.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that when the Spirit's at work, and that this person's made in the image of God, so there's certain things that person just can't escape. you know, even though they deny God, Romans 1 says, you know, we suppress the truth, but Romans 1 says we all, what truth are we suppressing? That we know God, that God's the creator. So because of that, I'm not saying people consciously, therefore, always, you know, oh, I'm suppressing the truth that there is a God, but they can't escape some of these kind of, these things about the world that they're in and about who they, and about humanity and their own humanity. And that with the kind of trust that God's at work and trust in a God who ultimately is the one who saves, that gives me a greater confidence to enter in a conversation, and also a recognition, and I didn't get to do this quite as much in the course, but the gospel, the New Testament can go to 1 Corinthians 15 and give you a list of the gospel, of what the gospel is. But then there's other ways that the gospel are presented. In fact, there's lots of ways that the gospel is presented. And sometimes the gospel is presented with, hey, Jesus is Lord. And that can make some of us uncomfortable because he's like, well, you didn't get the substitutionary atonement. It didn't get to this. But it doesn't mean in every conversation you're going to do everything. Again, take the weight off. It might, and there's a well-known apologist who says, you know, my job and our job is just to kind of put a little rock in their shoe, give them something to think about. And I think with text messaging and other things, we can come back to that rock. We can talk to them again, but then praying that the Spirit will work, that the Spirit is the great apologist who draws people to the Son. And just, I think that is why we should have confidence, even in the midst of polarization, even in the midst of times where we feel like no one's being persuaded of anyone, of anything, the Spirit still works. And so I think that's a good, you helped us kind of land the plane on reflecting on the Spirit's work and God's work in our conversations. I just want to end by saying two things. One, thank you for hanging around and carving out this hour. I know there's other things you can do on your Monday evening. So thank you for being part of these lessons and this conversation. The second thing is, let me know as you have feedback, as you have, hey, maybe we could do this. Maybe these themes would be helpful in a kind of course for unbelievers. That's something that internally we're speaking about, and you'll hear more about as we get closer to the new year and in the new year as we try to start off this course. And the next thing I would say, the final thing I would say, is be praying for that for us. Be praying for wisdom. Even if you don't have anything to add or advice to give, please pray for that. And we'd love for you to be a part of that and invite people to the course in the late winter or early spring. So blessings on each of you, and I look forward to, Lord willing, seeing you soon.